Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Can Roe v. Wade drive black voters to the polls? The opening of the student loan forgiveness portal is now open. Hearing aids, marijuana, Georgia elections, and yes, Kanye West. We are at the political roundtable tonight. My guests are Dr. Niambi Carter, political analyst and author of American While Black, African Americans, Immigration and the Limits of Citizenship, and Charles Ellison, publisher of the BNote.com. If you want to get in on this conversation, and I know you do, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at HFisher, WHUR, or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Dr. Carter, good to hear from you again.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
And Charles, how are you?
How you doing, sir? Always good to talk with you.
Always busy as ever. Let's get right into it today. As we know, President Biden was at the Howard Theater, the historic Howard Theater in the Shaw community near Howard University. He was giving a speech on Roe v. Wade. He was hoping to use that issue to motivate voters to go to the polls to make sure that Democrats keep the House and the Senate. Here is my question for you, Dr. Carter. He was in the Shaw community, an historically black community. Now, maybe not so much, but why come to the Howard Theater to talk about this issue? It's a curiosity.
Well, I mean, look, I think there are a number of reasons. One, he's not that popular right now. Two, he should have been there, right? I mean, if your VP is an alum of Howard and launched her campaign at that university, that should have been one of the first places you went. But I also think, you know, it's no secret that black women make up over 50% of the black electorate, which is about 33 million people in this country right now. And black women are highly motivated. They have been the ones who consistently turned out for Democrats in high numbers. So have black men, of course. But black women have been there, and this issue of abortion and reproductive rights is a top issue for black women. And so, I mean, I think if you're thinking about your appeal and a voting bloc that, quite frankly, has been a little lethargic in some times, meaning young people, not black people, young people, then, you know, this is sort of, I think, his attempt to gin up some interest and gin up some enthusiasm, which has been lagging, quite frankly, among this demographic and among, you know, some of his core set of voters.
So let me drill down on the black women thing just a little bit more. Reproductive rights, or better yet, let's talk about, health care, definitely. But do you think that the issue of abortion rights, Dr. Carter, resonates with black women as much as more broadly the issue of health care or access to health care? Are they two sides of the same coin, or are they separate?
I think so, because abortion is health care, you know, and it's just something that it uniquely falls on people who have the ability to carry children, right? We don't want to necessarily even have to gender it. So I definitely think that abortion is health care. And when we think about some of our communities that are more marginal, communities that are rural, that may not have access to regular health care, these same places where people may seek abortions are also some places where people get gynecologic care, get access to birth control and other kinds of contraception. I mean, there are a suite of things that abortion providers do, and most of them are actually not abortion. So I think this issue, coupled with just sort of these larger questions around how we improve black women's maternal health, right? I mean, black women are more likely to die in childbirth and have all kinds of complications, not likely to have their needs met. So I absolutely think abortion is a health care issue. I know we talk about them separately, but I think for many women, you know, what they have to do for their reproductive life isn't separate from this issue. I mean, just think about how much of a boon it was for many women to not have to pay co-pays for birth control pills after the Affordable Care Act was passed. So I definitely think that this is not a separate issue for many women.
Charles, at the risk of having you sleep on the sofa tonight.
No, not at all. Never that.
Your thoughts about Biden and the Roe v. Wade speech today, the codification of Roe v. Wade, if the Democrats keep the House and the Senate, he said that's the first measure that he would sign if that happens.
Right. Exactly. You know, they're absolutely trying to revive this issue because they got a lot of fire out of it after Roe v. Wade was overturned in the wake of that Dobbs decision. They've seen a lot of that that fire erode or sort of peter out, you know, since then over the summer, especially if there have been more heightened concerns over the economy, over issues such as inflation and also that public safety violent crime issue. There are some polls suggesting that Biden is regaining some, you know, he's not over 50%. Approval or popularity, but he's gained more approval and popularity. So, you know, he's toying with that. He's experimenting with that and saying, you know, going into venues where his core, most loyal audiences are to see how much more of that he can leverage or rebound on. Two, I completely agree that abortion, it depends on how you frame the abortion issue. You know, are we calling it abortion? No, it's about more than just abortion, about that one, that one technique or that one method within the universe of reproductive rights and maternal health care. You know, it's just about, you know, women's health care in general. Black women voters are extremely effective at the polls. This is their issue, particularly when you look at the states where already abortion trigger laws have been activated, especially those deep red states or those southern states. These are states where you have high concentrations of black people, of black voters. Also, you have very high black maternal mortality rates. You also have battleground states where black maternal mortality is very high. In my hometown, 75% of women who, in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, 75% of women who die from pregnancy-related complications are black. So this is very much, I think, you know, Democrats are banking on this still being an extremely resonant issue. Despite all the other issues looming that people are concerned about. And, you know, just like this issue of climate crisis, you know, there's the assumption that black people don't care about climate crisis, climate change. Well, the latest Hit Strategies Black Track poll shows 85% of black voters are being motivated by the climate crisis issue. So it depends on how the mainstream discourse frames these issues. These are very much frontline, number one or top priority issues for black voters.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We're at the political roundtable talking about some of the top political stories of the week. If you have a comment or question, give us a call. Shaka calling from Virginia. Thanks for calling quickly. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon, Mr. Fisher. Babe, turn that thing down. I'm on the phone.
turn that thing down.
We keep talking about maternity, black women dying. What are we going to do about it? I work in the healthcare field. I see racism. Racism towards black women in this country. We can keep talking about how they suffer, how black women are punishing maternity rate. But what are we going to do about it? And Joe Biden, when the Democrats need our vote, they go to the predominantly black neighborhood. I'm sick and tired with Democrats playing games with black people vote. I'm sick and tired with Democrats coming to our neighborhood talking all these lies. At the end of the day, they don't do nothing. But we can give Ukraine $17 billion when black people in Jackson, Mississippi don't have clean drinking water across the United States. What is Joe Biden going to do about the black people in Jackson, Mississippi, don't have clean water to drink, but we can give Ukraine $17 billion.
Okay.
Joe Biden, give the black people in Jackson, Mississippi $2.5 billion so they can have clean drinking water.
Well, Shaka, thank you so much. Real quick, Dr. Carter, your thoughts about what Shaka just shared?
I mean, I think that frustration is real, and I think many people feel it. I also think that we don't have, quite frankly, a good discussion about federal and state level politics here. Federal government can't do everything, and I'm not suggesting that there should be no accountability for Democrats. I absolutely think there is, and this kind of pandering is something we talk about again and again. Don't just show up at election time, right? Earn our vote every single day. And I think that's legitimate. But I also think that sometimes we think of the federal government as the government, and we often forget that in local communities like Jackson, in places like Flint, right, there are state boards and local boards that manage water, Louisiana, right, where we talk often about these crises in the federal sense. And, yes, federal government has a role to play here. But we also have to look at our state and local officials as well and hold their feet to the fire. And part of that is us, right? We stay for the big show, but then we slack off when it comes to our state and local elections. Like right now, many of us are not just talking about Congress at the in the House and Senate races. We also have state legislative races. We have circuit court judge races. We have gubernatorial races. And in quite frankly, in many cases, for some of the issues that Shaka pointed out, but some of the things that we talk about that we care about are going to happen at state and local levels, and even on the maternal health. I mean, that's about a lot of things, not just sort of what the federal government can do, but how are we talking about how we train providers in culturally competent care. Thinking about when we talked about the Affordable Care Act, the things we left off the table, because there's more to maternal health than a woman getting pregnant. We know that people who are underserved, and even the people who are, you know, people who go to for regular checkups, et cetera, do also face consequences of death or serious illness. Look at Serena Williams, right? When she went to have her baby, one of the most fit, well-to-do, well-known people, and she's married to a rich white man and almost died giving birth. So this is, I think, a deeper issue than just, you know, the government writ large.
So I would say this, Howard. Yeah, so what I would say here is that, you know, we need to, you know, first of all, dismantle this notion that Democrats aren't doing anything, that the Biden administration isn't doing anything. I mean, he passed the American Relief Plan. That was $1.2 trillion. All that pandemic relief, child tax credit, was the Biden administration's idea. That cut child poverty in half. They need to reinstate that, but Republicans have been blocking it. The bipartisan infrastructure law, that's already dollars from that are already circulating. In fact, it was the Biden administration. It was congressional Democrats who authorized that money, sent it to Mississippi. So about $450 million, about $100 million was supposed to go to Jackson, but Republicans, the governor, and the state legislature have blocked that money from black people in Jackson, Mississippi to get that. So, you know, going back to that conversation about how state and federal coordination works, the federal government gives the money to the states, and then states are blocking these states that are run by Republicans, keep blocking this money so that majority black cities can get it for things like infrastructure in Jackson or violent crime in places like Philadelphia. So we first need to push back against that notion and then, you know, understand that, okay, well, you know, who do we want taking over or running government and managing these multiple crises? Do we want an administration that is actually doing that, has been trying to do that under much duress since coming into power in 2021 and not even getting a transition when they did come into power? Or do we want you know, racist white supremacists or a political party that's not even legitimate because it's engaged in domestic terrorism. And its policy platform is completely built on dismantling or destroying the rights of black people. I mean, they're totally focused on destroying voting rights or destroying abortion rights or throwing more police at us. They have no policy proposals other than stochastic terrorism and violent white supremacy. That's it. As you know, so Democrats aren't perfect, but I think we need to see how clear the choice is and also understand, you know, what existential choice we have to make come 2022. Democrats have been doing a lot, not perfect, but Democrats have been at work while Republicans have been engaged in all levels of white terrorism. I would rather go with the people who are trying to work and manage these crises.
Yeah, it sounds like a devil you do versus the devil you you don't know.
You do know.
Yeah, exactly. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are at the political roundtable talking about some of the top political stories of the past week, and we've got a lot on the table coming up. We're going to be talking about the student loan portal. It is open, as it refers to student loan debt forgiveness. A lot of folks want to talk about that also. Can you hear me now? Hearing aids over the counter and much, much cheaper. Also, we're going to be talking about the politics of the Georgia elections coming up. Legalized marijuana in Maryland. It's on the ballot. And of course, Kanye West. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM channel 141. And don't forget, you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Insight segment via podcast on WHUR.com. I post it every night on our website after 8:30. If you're on the phone, stay with us. That includes Kevin calling from Virginia. This conversation will continue on Sirius XM channel 141 and 96.3 HD2. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. We'll be back with this conversation in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We're at the political roundtable with Dr. Nyambi Carter, political analyst and author of American While Black, African Americans, Immigration, and the Limits of Citizenship, and Charles Ellison, publisher of the BNote.com. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're going to come right back to you, even if you want to talk about something we've already discussed, but I do want to move forward just a little bit. Let us talk about the student loan portal. It opened this week to help those Americans who have been struggling with student loan debt. Big deal for African Americans, obviously. You know, Charles, we're talking about federal student loans, for example, Pell Grants. Some say it's not enough. I don't know. If I had a Pell Grant and, you know, if somebody was going to, you know, eliminate $20,000 worth of debt, I'd be pretty daggone happy.
Right. I mean, first of all, you know, the vast majority of student loan borrowers who are going to benefit from this are 90%, in fact, are people who make under $75,000 a year. A huge chunk of student loan borrowers, I believe the majority of student loan borrowers who receive Pell Grants are, people are black people, are black college graduates, or black people who did not, even because of the cost of college, couldn't get their degrees. So this is significant. I mean, those who took out a Pell Grant who signed up for this relief will get $20,000 off their student loan. So if you had, like, already your balance is down to, you know, $19,000, I mean, you're done. I mean, your student loan balance comes to zero. For those who didn't take out a Pell Grant, that's still significant, $10,000. So, you know, clearly the Biden administration, I mean, it had hinted at, it had said, the president himself said, hey, listen, we would love to do, you know, cancellation up to $50,000. But once again, that is a form of relief that Republicans kept blocking. And then you had like a huge backlash from mainstream media about, you know, that being unfair and the public conversation around it being distorted and all this disinformation about it being like, oh, well, you know, this is something where, you know, people who did take out student loans and paid it all back, you know, they're not receiving some form of relief. But, I mean, when you have that much, I mean, what we're talking about, $2 trillion worth of total student loan debt, that's 10% of national gross domestic product. That's unsustainable. That's a crisis for the economy. You can't have that many people in that much debt and expect the economy to remain stable. So it's as good as it gets right now.
Yeah, Dr. Carter, you've been a college professor for almost your entire career. You know what students go through trying to stay in school.
Absolutely. I was a Pell Grant recipient. I'm still paying student loans.
Right?
So I graduated with Pluto, still a planet. So, I mean, absolutely. I mean, it's a struggle, and I think as Charles rightly points out, I mean, most black students wouldn't get through college without access to some sort of loan. And I think that's, you know, our shame, quite frankly, in this idea that people should pay on this forever just to prove some point is really ridiculous. I mean, people going so far as to, people, I mean, Republicans, going so far as to file lawsuits, right, to try to prevent this from happening. For what? I mean, as you know, you know, 10,000, max 20,000 is as good as it's probably going to get for now. But the idea that that is even a bridge too far, when we think about what it takes to generate and build wealth in this country, $20,000 is a drop in the bucket, right? But it is certainly a weight off a lot of our shoulders, an albatross off of a lot of our shoulders for those of us who are still paying for educations we received 20, 30 years ago. And for my students who are, many of whom are Pell Grant recipients, you know, they talked about the experience of applying for this relief. And it was probably one of the first times that I heard students actually were excited and said that something worked. And it wasn't cumbersome, and it wasn't odious, right, that they made it easy for them to actually take advantage of this benefit. Because believe it or not, there will still be for some people who won't take advantage for a myriad of reasons.
Yeah.
Either they don't know, they're too proud, or they think, oh, maybe that's not for me, this is some sort of government handout, whatever their reason, right? So there are still going to be people who won't take advantage of it, despite the sort of easier sort of access to it. And I think we have to be real about that too, and what for those people, because in some ways you say this is something that we could just say blanket forgiveness. We know who has Pell Grants and who doesn't, right? And we could just say let's forgive it. Of course we're not going to do that, but we could actually do that if we really cared about freeing people from this burden. However, I do think it's a step in the right direction, and hopefully this will help millions of black families on their steps to wealth generation, because the reason they went to college and took on this debt in the first place was because of the promise of what this education could bring. And so hopefully this debt relief will be able to free up those black families so that they can do other things.
Yeah. Let me go to Kevin on the line calling from Virginia. Kevin, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. This is great conversations going on. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
When I was in college and a little bit after, I worked for a Democratic state senator from Virginia. He ran in office for the first about 9 years of his 29-year career in the Senate of Virginia. The last 20, he ran unopposed. And the reason was it's because both Democrats and Republicans voted for this gentleman. And so when I hear the debates going back and forth, depending on who's in office, they, as you all pointed out, you block the other party's initiatives, and then when the other party gets in, they block in reply. So my question really is how do we break this thing and get back to a place where people that are in office really put in the time, the hard work it takes to be a public servant, so that they gain the respect of both sides, and we don't have this teeter-totter thing going on and nothing gets done.
Well, let me see, Kevin, let me have Dr. Carter real briefly react to your question, because I would argue, Dr. Carter, that the Republicans, and some may even say the Democrats of today, are not like the ones 29 years ago.
Perhaps, right? But I think we are who we are. And so some of what we see in government is a reflection of us. I think we think about political officials and others as being separate from us. But we elect them, and we put them there. sometimes time after time, even to our detriment. So I think, you know, I understand Kevin's frustration, right, that this polarization and this attempt to block, you know, the other party or prevent their success is frustrating. At the same time, though, I think the only people we have to look to are ourselves. And wonder, what is this about? Because people are sending Marjorie Taylor Greene to Congress precisely because she's an obstructionist. People keep reelecting Mitch McConnell precisely because he's an obstructionist, right? People send people like this to Congress for a reason. And I think we have to, I mean, not just to say, you know, focus on the net negatives, but when we see where we are, it's because of who we are.
Yeah.
We made this.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for your phone call. Let's go to Renee calling from Herndon, Virginia.
Real quick, Charles. Yeah, we have to come to grips with this is not just your everyday standard polarization between political parties. This is pure unadulterated racism. You know, the late law professor Terry Smith, black law professor, outlined this in his book that came out in 2020 called Whitelash, and unfortunately he passed away before we could have further conversations with him about it. But we need to start being real with ourselves and understanding that an election cycle like this and the most recent election cycles in modern American politics have been about two choices. The candidates that are perceived as most closely aligned with black interest or racial equity, and the candidates who are not aligned with black interest or perceived as being not aligned with black interest. And Republicans gave up the right to being a legitimate political party when they endorsed and carried out January 6th. And when they aligned themselves fully, unapologetically, embraced white nationalist rhetoric and white nationalist policy platforms. I mean, they're in the our voting rights are being destroyed as we speak. That those arguments took place in the Supreme Court last week. They're taking out Section 2. That's it. So your voting rights are going to depend on where you live. There's actually Jim Crow level theft of black voting rights happening right now in Florida. Black people are being put in jail for exercising their right to vote because of the policy that's been implemented here. So this is not about, this is not, the Republican, we could have had this conversation about both sides 20 years ago. I would have gave you that conversation 20 years ago. We're faced with a real existential and racially divisive white nationalist threat right now. And we need to come to grips with that. And once we do, we can fix it.
Yeah, we don't hear a whole lot of that big tent talk that we heard when John McCain was alive, for example. So certainly things have changed. Renee, thank you for hanging on. Calling from Herndon, what's on your mind?
Hi, yes. So I hear that you have two Democrats, black Democrats speaking. And
I didn't say we have two political analysts speaking, but please, what's your comment?
And they are Democrats.
We didn't ask that. Let's not say that. But go ahead with what's on your mind.
All right. They talk about the Democrat Party's policies. And I believe, as a black American, that it's too much spending. All the spending, these trillions and trillions in spending has caused inflation. All the printing of money is causing inflation. And now it's harder to get a house because the interest rates are more than doubled. So it's like mortgages are twice as much. And that's the best way. According to Sheila Jackson Lee, I heard her give a speech, and she said home ownership is a great way to get wealth. So instead of giving us peanuts, you know, and now blocking us from being able to own a home, it's not doing us any favors. And I don't believe that abortion rights and health care for women are the same. I think they're in contrast to each other. I think that there's too much abortion in the black community. I don't think that's right to be aborting so many black babies nowadays. I mean, maybe there was, you know, in the past we didn't have a lot of birth control. It wasn't working, but we're educated now. We know what it takes to get pregnant, and we can be a little more responsible with our reproductive rights and cut down on some of these abortions.
Okay. Renee, thank you so much. Dr. Carter, your thoughts about Renee, what she's saying?
Look, I mean, I think Renee has a right to her opinion. I disagree with Renee. I think, you know, home ownership has been sold as a boon for black wealth generation, right? But we have to remember, when we enter our homes, we also do, meaning we black people, when we enter into home ownership, we also do so typically with less wealth anyway. So our wealth is all in our house. And anybody who owns a home can tell you, a home is really nothing but a works progress administration for other people. Whether it's your plumbing or your electrical or your roof or your yard, it is not just a matter of going to get a mortgage. And I can understand inflation is high and people are feeling the pinch. But we also don't want to happen in 2008 and 2009, right, with the housing downturn. Because what did we see? We saw almost 40%, I think it might be a little higher, of black people lose their wealth because they lost their home.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be very careful about whether home ownership is going to be that building block. It will be for some of us. But for those of us who are more marginal in that market, whether the interest rate is 3.5% or 6%, home ownership might not be the tool to generate wealth for you, because you also have to take care of it. It's not just paying the mortgage. And I'm not saying that to belittle how impactful home ownership can be, but we look at places like Prince George's County, right, that are still rebounding from that loss of black wealth, that is still not finding itself on equal footing. And then when we look at the work of like people like Kianga Yamada Taylor, and talks about how that same industry worked to make sure that black homes were undervalued, that black people had a harder time obtaining mortgages, things that are still happening. So I wouldn't put as much on this home ownership as the sort of only path to black wealth building. And in terms of thinking about, you know, abortion and whether it's health care or whether it's not, and whether people have access to abortion, one of the things to be very clear is, yes, birth control is out here, but there are still underserved segments of our community. And black women are underserved. When we think about access to contraception, I think many of us think that people just go to the doctor and pop in and get pills, or pop in and get condoms. But there is a lot of shame associated with that. There is a lot of lack of health care and lack of health care awareness, both for providers and seekers of health care. So, yes, these things are more plentiful, but they're not always accessible. And then I also think, one other quick thing I should say here is, we also like to shame black women for the reproductive choices that they make. Mm-hmm. And so I think when we think about whether black women are seeking abortions or not, I mean, the same person might turn around and say, well, they had another baby they can't afford.
Yeah.
So I think we have to get our hands around this and not be so quick to look at black women as sort of the villains in this narrative.
Yeah. Let me move on. Still a lot to get to. Charles, I hope you hear this, the hearing aids over the counter now available, FDA giving that approval. And, you know, hearing aids are, before all of this, were just disrespectfully expensive. I know the struggle that my father had with just paying for, you know, for his, just real crazy. Talk to me about, you know, this seems to be really, is this a watershed moment for something that, you know, heretofore people just didn't talk a lot about, but it was just kind of hanging in the background when you talk about expense?
Right. You know, that's those are the types of expenses that, you know, kind of fly under the radar, but that we all absorb. At very excessive rates, those very kind of quiet under the radar health expenses, things that are impacting our public health that are very disruptive in our families and our households, that drain savings accounts or that drain bank accounts, because you know, many of us, particularly in the more marginalized populations that are already struggling, you know, from low to moderate income, can't afford those things as simple as access to a hearing aid. So it can very well be described as a watershed event. You know, it's a reflection of how broken and dysfunctional the American healthcare system is, because you're not dealing, you know, things like a hearing aid are very simple to come by in other advanced countries.
And so, you know, like I think I was saying something recently, a tweet from a doctor of South Korean descent who went to South Korea and was talking about how easy it was for her to get something like eyeglasses. But, you know, here in the United States, even to get eyeglasses, it's a struggle. It's an experience. It's time and it's a lot of money. You know, her frame's just costing $80 in South Korea, an advanced economy. So we make things like unusually and unnecessarily difficult in the United States. But oh, that's right. It works in South Korea because there everyone's Korean. It's a homogeneous society. But here, you know, in a multiracial society, like, you know, folks have to be forced into or placed into these marginalized buckets. And you know, we're still not, you know, coming to full grips with the legacy of racism and also, you know, all these inequities that are just unnecessary. I mean, the American economy, because of this, lost over a 20-year period from 2000 to 2020, $16 trillion. Now, I didn't say that. Citibank said that. Citibank did that study. Mm-hmm. $16 trillion. That's nearly like an entire year's worth of U.S. gross domestic product. So, you know, we keep doing these things that are inefficient, that are, you know, punitive, that are excessively expensive, you know, things in our healthcare system, for example, simple things like a hearing aid.
Yeah.
And what it does is that it's bringing us on the verge of collapse, and it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah. Let me move on to the other really, really big issue. Georgia on our minds, Georgia on everybody's mind. My goodness, we've got, you know, Stacey Abrams running for governor again against Brian Kemp. And, of course, this Herschel Walker and the Raphael Warnock contest for the Senate. I'll just let you jump right in, Dr. Carter. What sticks out for you?
Well, I mean, look, I think, you know, a lot of attention was given to the debates, for example, this week. And debates are not changing anyone's minds. I mean, Herschel Walker had to do the minimum to be considered successful. Raphael Warnock just had to not step on his own tongue. I mean, they're really just, at least political theater, nobody's making up their mind because of a debate. And the same thing with Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp. But I do think when we talk about who folks want to represent them nationally and at the state level, I think we have clear choices. The contrast could not be greater. However, right, people still like to treat politics like a spectator sport where it's your team versus the other team. But the stakes are a lot higher than it is if you're watching, you know, the Ravens play the Bills, right? So, you know, I think Georgia has some big decisions ahead, as do other states like Pennsylvania, like Arizona, like Wisconsin, and so many others this election cycle. But, you know, I think a lot of attention was given to the debates, but debates aren't really going to be the thing that moves the needle either way.
Do you think, Charles, that the controversies surrounding Herschel Walker is illuminating when it comes to this contest or even the broader national contest?
Well, you know, first I have to say this, Howard. You know,
there Could you call me Howard one more time?
Harold.
Go ahead.
But you know, I'm going between talk shows.
I got you.
But I appreciate that. But you know what? Yeah, I'll say this. You know, there is another candidate running in the U.S. Senate race in Georgia. I mean, it's the incumbent, you know, current U.S. Senator Ralph Warnock. And so, you know, I think a lot of this excessive mainstream media focus on the melee surrounding Herschel Walker, I mean, it's really like, I mean, mainstream media is not acting like real journalism. You know, it's acting like a high school newspaper. And so, you know, and trying to highlight the messiest candidate and not really, but also cover and acknowledge that there's a very credible candidate and credible incumbent, credible policymaker that's running for that same seat. So that's one. It's just the messiness of corporate mainstream journalism, you know, spending so much time, an inordinate amount of time, on this clown show that is Herschel Walker. It's offensive. And so, you know, what now, coming out of Georgia at this moment, are some encouraging signs. We've seen a 90-plus percent increase in early voting since 2018, a 90% difference in terms of the amount of ballots that were the amount of ballots that were registered so far in 2022 compared to this same time in early voting in 2018 in Georgia. So hopefully that's a good sign for both Reverend Ralph Warnock and also Stacey Abrams with this increased turnout. But we have this really serious problem here in American politics where a lot of we've completely butchered the notion of public service and just accepted that anyone could run for any sort of public office and it's become a complete abomination in terms of some of the candidates that we're now seeing running for office and especially these statewide offices. And that's something after this 2022 election that I hope we can fix.
Dr. Carter, can we expect that Maryland will smell like the District of Columbia when it comes to marijuana after? I'm trying to drive home out of D.C. and you know who's smoking a doobie.
Well, I think we're already tiptoeing in that direction, so it's quite possible. There's already medical marijuana in Maryland, so I don't see it being that far afield to say, we go the way of D.C. or Massachusetts, where you don't necessarily have to have a medical card and you can go to a dispensary as an adult. And then I think if we at least see the nod from the Biden administration saying they're decriminalizing possession, that perhaps that will embolden not just Marylanders, but other states who are thinking about this move. It generates lots of tax revenue. So I think many places are wondering why the prohibition, and when you really think about why marijuana was classified in the first place as a controlled substance the way it was, that was about racism. That was about black men and this idea that black people were uniquely affected by marijuana and needed to control black men in particular because this substance was thought to be so inhibiting to black men's discretion that they would, come after and attack white women. So, I think people are seeing sort of positive net effects from a legalization movement or at least a decriminalization movement. And then we think about how many black young lives have been, harmed, affected, thrown away over something that is now considered, de rigueur, right? It's like it's gross and it's insulting. And those are the very same people who won't be able to get rich off of it, coincidentally, right? Because they won't be able to get licenses. But I do think Maryland might be creeping in that direction.
Final topic, I want both of you to comment on this. I'll start with you, Charles. A lot of attention being paid to Kanye West. I'm not a fan. Don't know. Okay. And, I'm talking about his music. But, the White Lives Matter T-shirt incident with conservative Candace Owens that got a lot of press, and also now we understand that the mother of George Floyd's daughter is suing him because of the statements that he made during a podcast saying that George Floyd died as a result of fentanyl, his fentanyl use, and not with a knee on his neck. Charles, first of all, why are we paying so much attention to Kanye West?
Yeah, the same week that we were talking about Kanye West and Herschel Walker's abortions was the same week that the Supreme Court was putting the final nail in the coffin of the Voting Rights Act 57 years after its passage. That's the conversation that black people need to be having. That we need to be outraged about. But, we're now here, and the black pop culture discourse around Kanye West needs to stop giving him excuses and stop just, chalking it off to or chalking it up to mental illness. No, he knows exactly what he's doing. George Floyd's family should sue him. I just feel like, rappers, reality shows mixed in with racism, it's like the death of black people. Like, it's like it has to stop. It's just an endless vicious cycle. Yeah. And Kanye's not the only one.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Dr. Carter, your thoughts about this Kanye West kerfuffle?
I think the less we think of Kanye West, the better. The less we think about him. I mean, we clearly use the word genius too lightly. And, you know, all these people who, as Charles said, are caping for him and making excuses and also calling themselves politically informed people are paying this person who is not a public official, who's a multi-millionaire, if not a billionaire. I guess it depends on who you ask. And we are supposed to be listening to him, you know, regurgitate anti-Semitic conspiracies that we've been hearing for the last umpteen years and feeling sorry for him because these partnerships with these white companies that he coveted so much didn't turn out the way he wanted. And now, you know, he's throwing a temper tantrum and looking for attention in all the wrong places, toying with white supremacy because he knows it's a quick way to make a buck, but also it's a fast way to make yourself special. And so that he surrounds himself with sycophants and grifters like Candace Owens, I'll say alleged grifter Candace Owens, who will, you know, support these really dangerous narratives about White Lives Matter. They already believe this. We already know this, right? I mean, the Unite the Right rally, what did they say? You will not replace us.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly he is preaching to his own choir now. I think we need to resign him to the dustbin of white supremacy and let that rest. And let him be over there and do what he does, but he is not worth our attention. There are much bigger matters that we need to be thinking about than the shenanigans of a Kanye West. And I think, you know, also this is a message to hip-hop media as well.
Yeah.
Stop platforming this man. He is not that deep. He's not that smart. He's not that worthwhile. There are lots of interesting young people out here doing lots of interesting young things that you can talk to them about, and it doesn't have to be Kanye West in his middle, 30s or 40s now, carrying on.
God, the dust.
Well, he never wrote his own lyrics anyway. Yeah.
The dustbin of white supremacy. Use your words. Use your words. I love it. Dr. Niambi Carter and Charles Ellison, thank you so much for talking to us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks so much, Charles. Take care.
That is the Daily Drum for this Tuesday, October 18th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.